Welcome to the Michael Jackson Case for Innocence podcast. My name is Cheryl.
And I'm June. In today's episode, we'll conclude our four-part series on Leaving Neverland.
You can find all source material for this episode on our website, MichaelJacksonCaseForInnocence.com.
Over the previous two episodes, we've broken down the content of this HBO film, highlighting its many misleading and contradictory narratives, and concluding that this documentary should not be trusted.
In this final episode on Leaving Neverland, with the help of voice actor Gary Middleton, we'll be looking at the comments made by filmmaker Dan Reed in his promotional interviews, and show through these comments how Reed is willing to protect his film narrative at all costs, even when it means breaching the ethics of journalism.
We'll close out the episode by evaluating how Leaving Neverland measures up to accepted standards of documentary filmmaking.
After watching Leaving Neverland and researching its claims, I became skeptical of its content and deceptive editing, which we already covered. Compounding my skepticism was hearing the comments of Dan Reed in his promotional interviews for the film. Because Reed didn't show his validation process in the movie, I was hoping in his interviews he would explain how he reconciled all the contradictory evidence, especially from the lawsuits of his own film subjects. But I found his interview responses to be smoke and mirrors. When faced with criticism, Reed evades honest engagement with evidence by becoming morally indignant, insisting that all you need to know is in the film. Reed attacks the Jackson family and estate. He belittles Jackson fans, and he disparages anyone who questions his subject's truthfulness. We're going to go through some of Dan Reed's interview responses that expose his lack of interest in the accuracy of his film.
In his Vanity Fair interview from February 2019, Dan Reed says he didn't interview anyone but the accusers and their families in his film because what are they going to say? That Jackson's a nice guy?
This answer strikes me as brazenly disingenuous, because interviewing all involved parties is part of the standard validation process, if you want to claim impartiality. Here's Reed himself in a radio interview from 2019.
Did you ever approach any of the Jacksons to come on and show their side of the story in this documentary?
Well, I mean, what's their side of the story? Michael was a great guy and he would never do anything like that. I mean, that's not really, it doesn't, you know, when you're talking about a really serious crime that happened behind closed doors with no witnesses, and what's the point of bringing on a family member who's got a huge interest in defending the brand?
the brand is right.
Was a great guy, you know?
That is true.
Reed implies that the only information he would attain from interviewing someone who defends Michael Jackson is that they will say he's a nice guy. But how does he know what they'll say unless he gives defenders the time and space to present their case? Reed might find out through interviewing others that these accusers have a history of deceit, much like the Arvizo family had a long history of deceit. His lack of curiosity about what others might say about Robson and Safechuck's story shows Reed to be approaching his film not as a journalist but as a screenwriter, trying to find the ideal narrative of sex abuse to move his audience into shock and belief.
If Reed was actually interested in the truth of the claims, he might have started his investigative research by talking to Charles Thompson, an award-winning British journalist with an encyclopedic knowledge of the Jackson allegations. Since Reed came into this project knowing nothing, Thompson could have helped Reed get up to speed on these cases and their credibility issues. Thompson has read, analyzed, and written about the thousands of pages of legal documents in all of the Jackson cases. He was interviewed in British and Australian media as a counter-interview once Leaving Neverland was released. Here's Charles Thompson from one of these interviews.
Your thoughts on the documentary which aired last night?
Well, I've spent the last 5 years following the court case, which is not ended, by the way. They're still trying to reprise it now. And the court case, which has been going on since 2012-13, to date has generated thousands of pages of public record documents, deposition transcripts, witness statements, disclosure, etc. And when you actually get into the nitty-gritty of those court documents, it tells a very different story than the one which is being told on screen in this documentary. These men, they did previously testify in Michael Jackson's defense, but that's not the only inconsistency. Since they came forward, they've repeatedly changed and contradicted their own stories. And one of them was actually caught deliberately lying under oath to such an extent that the judge reprimanded him, threw his entire witness statement out of the case, and said that no rational juror could ever believe his story. And this is a side of the story which is not being told by any media which is covering the case. And it's quite disturbing to watch as a journalist to see basically a universal catastrophic failure in journalism. Nobody is attempting to provide any balance.
Not once do you hear Thompson using Reed's, "well, he's a nice guy" argument when defending Michael Jackson. Thompson uses Robson and Safechuck's own testimony to show a pattern of deceit. He uses their own testimony to contradict their claims in Leaving Neverland. And he also uses his understanding of prior cases against Jackson to help put these more recent ones in perspective. Thompson should have been an obvious choice for Reed to interview, to get an evidence-based counter-narrative.
Reed states in his Oprah interview, among many others, that he didn't interview anyone but Robson and Safechuck because they were the only ones there when the doors were closed and the lights went out.
This is a very dramatic and unfair response. Then why did Reed interview police and prosecution lawyers, the only other people he talked to besides the families? The police weren't in the room and the lights went out. Neither were the accuser's family members. And why was Reed not interested in interviews with others who had the same type of friendship with Jackson when they were kids, like Brett Barnes, Macaulay Culkin, the Cassios, Jonathan Spence, or Emmanuel Lewis? They were there when the lights went out and were much closer friends with Jackson. But Reed is incurious about their stories of what happened and the possibility of hearing substantive information to support why Jackson wasn't a child molester. But Reed will never know because he never asked. It's unfair for Reed to say the only people he should interview are Robson and Safechuck because no one else could know what happened behind closed doors, because that presumes these guys are telling the truth.
Reed could interview people who might challenge the credibility of Wade Robson, like his former long-term girlfriend Brandi Jackson, or people who knew him in the dance community, like Lavelle Smith Jr. or Sean Welling. Both have publicly stated that they don't believe Wade based on their knowledge of Wade personally, and there are many people who are implicated in this film as enablers. Jackson's employees, managers, assistants, and even his musical collaborators are basically said to have cast a blind eye to the abuse because of Jackson's massive celebrity status. Here's Reed in another 2019 interview talking about these alleged enablers.
You think of the people in Jackson's entourage who watched little boy after little boy after little boy after little boy after little boy go through this process of being wooed and, you know, showered with attention and gifts and then, you know, invited to spend time at Neverland and finally ending up in Jackson's bed. And you wonder, how did they interpret this? What did they think was going on in that bedroom between Jackson and the little boy? I mean, I've never actually heard anyone from the estate or the family kind of talk us through what they thought was going on in the bedroom when the lights went out.
It sounds like Reed has posed some great questions for a proper journalist to investigate here. He says he's never heard any of Jackson's employees explain their observations, and he wonders what they'd say. But if Reed is going to implicate these employees, I think he has an obligation to do better than wonder. He should have asked them. For example, Wade Robson said he was abused in Jackson's recording studio. But Reed never reached out to anyone who was working in the studio to get their side of the story. Studio engineer Brad Sundberg says in an interview that he was there every day with Jackson during the recording of the Dangerous album, which was the album he was working on when Wade says abuse happened. Sundberg has given very thoughtful and detailed responses to this allegation by Wade, noting how abuse would be basically impossible in this studio. And he's offended at the accusation that these professional, serious studio engineers were somehow oblivious or even worse, protecting Jackson. Before Reed publicly implies such an offense, it seems professional ethics would demand that he would thoroughly examine the claims and be willing to talk to all the parties involved. I think if Dan Reed were being honest, he would say he didn't interview anyone on Jackson's side because he was trying to keep it a secret. The Jackson estate and the Jackson family were both blindsided by the documentary. Reed did not want to reach out to interview anyone who might tell the estate or family, because then they'd have time to prepare a preemptive claim-by-claim rebuttal, which would take away from the film's impact. You can check our website for further evidence that Dan Reed was keeping his project secret until its release.
When Dan Reed is asked in interviews about the financial motives of his subjects, he flatly denies it, saying Robson and Safechuck are suing not for money, but to get their story out there. Reed then redirects the question to denounce the financial motives of the Jackson family and estate in their criticism of leaving Neverland.
This is Reed's ka-ching response. Here's what Reed says in a Billboard interview from January 2019.
Every time a song plays, a cash register goes ka-ching, it doesn't surprise me that they've come out fighting in defense of their asset.
In his Today Show interview, Reed is asked if the accusations of Robson and Safechuck are about money, referring to their lawsuits filed against Jackson's companies. Reed deflects the question.
It is about money. It's about the Jackson estate's money and protecting an asset.
In his Good Morning Britain interview, when asked about the accusers' financial motives, Reed tells Piers Morgan,
"Oh, you're swallowing the Jackson line hook, line, and sinker, that it's all about the money."
As if it's unreasonable to question the motives of these accusers when there are millions of dollars in a lawsuit payout at stake. Fair journalism would require a filmmaker to be transparent about the potential financial motives, not just on the side of the Jackson estate, but also on the side of these accusers. Dan Reed refuses to acknowledge that Robson and Safechuck have a financial incentive in their accusations. Here he is in his Good Morning Britain interview of 2019, one of the few interviews where Reed was pushed on this point of money motive.
If there's a potential financial payout of hundreds of millions of dollars, there is an incentive there. If people were being disingenuous, if they were changing a story, if they were making things up, and I'm not saying they are, I'm just putting it to you, there is an incentive there, a huge financial incentive for these two guys.
A huge financial
family.
Incentive for the Jackson organization to cover up this crime.
Correct. I agree.
An even bigger incentive, because what's real is the estate's earnings. That's real. What the Jackson estate are talking about, these guys making money.
Dan Reed is also not being upfront about his own self-interest in a guilty Michael Jackson, both financially and in prestige. Reed had little visibility as a filmmaker prior to leaving Neverland. In a number of interviews, he describes how he was searching for a big investigative story, an iconic American story that had the power to engage audiences on a global scale, which never happened with any of his prior films. And as the tabloid press has shown over the decades, nothing grabs people's attention like sensational stories about Michael Jackson. This Michael Jackson movie, with all of its graphic details, is Reed's opportunity to break out and make a global name for himself. He has no movie if these allegations are false. Knowing Reed's financial and prestige investment in a guilty narrative is why viewers of Leaving Neverland should be extra cautious when just accepting the story without a transparent verification process. So the honest answer to the question about financial motive is that Reed, Robson, Safechuck, and the Jackson estate all have a financial interest in whether or not these accusations are seen as credible.
The vague and nonspecific research mentioned by Dan Reed in his interviews reveals his guilty bias. When asked how he vet the claims of Robson and Safechuck, Reed only mentions talking to the 2005 lawyers and sheriff's department involved in prosecuting Jackson. Reed says he interviewed them to validate his subjects' claims.
They are the perfect sources to go to if you want to validate the accuser's claims, because the prosecutors and police aggressively pursued and developed the case against Jackson, but they lost in court.
Michael Jackson was acquitted on 14 counts in the 2005 trial, and two grand juries failed to indict him in 1994. This was the biggest case of their careers, and they lost it in a public humiliation, so police and prosecutors are incentivized to promote the Jackson is guilty narrative. These police detectives that Reed talked with were the ones who jumped to the conclusion that Jackson was guilty, then arrested him after only talking to the accuser and his family. They then sought out only confirmatory evidence and ignored exculpatory evidence.
Dan Reed ridicules the idea of talking to the Jackson estate, because of their motive to protect what he calls their cash cow. But Reed is being hypocritical when he ignores the fact that the prosecutors and detectives have their own vested interest in a guilty narrative to protect their reputations. The evidence Reed considers should be based on its merits, not whether or not it comes from the Jackson estate. Just because the Jackson estate lawyers have financial incentive in promoting Jackson's innocence, it doesn't mean they have no ability to present Reed with impartial evidence. The estate would likely have shared with Reed the judge rulings in Robson and Safechuck's lawsuits, showing evidence that they lied under oath for monetary gain. Dan Reed shows his hand by admitting talking only to the police and prosecutors. It reveals that he was exclusively interested in evidence that confirmed what he already decided was the angle of his movie, that Jackson was a child predator.
In his Good Morning Britain interview, Reed says he found massive corroborating evidence for Robson and Safechuck's claims of abuse. But when asked to elaborate, he only mentions eyewitness statements by the cook, the chambermaid, and the driver.
Reed doesn't give names here, but he's likely referring to Blanca Francia, Philip Lamarck, and Mark Keendoy, who all came up with their stories only when tabloid money was offered. Francia can't keep her story straight. Lamarck was caught lying on the witness stand, and Keendoy had such poor credibility, even among the tabloids, that Snedden didn't bring him to testify in 1994. The driver he referred to would be either Mark Keendoy or Jackson's longtime driver, Gary Hearn, who's had his testimony twisted by the media, as explained in the Chandler episodes, but who has steadfastly supported Jackson's innocence under oath.
It was astonishing to hear Reed only refer to these former employees when trying to explain his massive corroborating evidence. If he isn't going to present his corroborating evidence in the film, Reed should at least have a website where he can walk his audience through his evidence and explain how he reconciled all the credibility issues with these eyewitnesses he uses to support the case for Jackson's guilt. But he doesn't do this. He just says, "Trust me, I saw the evidence."
Dan Reed is cavalier about challenging the verdict in the 2005 trial against Jackson.
He parrots the prosecution's spin that Jackson was acquitted because of the focus on the mother, Janet Arvizo, who he excuses by offhandedly remarking that her offense was shoplifting.
Here's Reed in his Good Morning Britain interview.
Is other than what they're saying, did you unearth any actual evidence that proves Michael Jackson was a paedophile?
Well, there's masses of corroborating evidence. If you look at the investigations that the LAPD and the Santa Barbara Sheriff's Department carried out in 1993 when Jordan Chandler came forth with his accusations, and in 2003 to 2005 when 13-year-old Gavin Arvizo accused Michael of molesting him. So there's masses of you know, eyewitness statements by Neverland staff, by the chambermaid, by the driver, by the cook.
But none of it convicted him.
Well, that's an astonishing, isn't it? I mean, that's because the Jackson organization and the lawyers did what they do very well. They said, look the other way. Look at Gavin's mum in the case of the little boy in the trial. She's a dreadful person and she, you know, shoplifted and she did this and that. And there was a lot of evidence in the 2005 trial that pointed to Jackson's guilt. Very good evidence.
But Jackson was acquitted.
If Reed wants to propose an honest challenge to the U.S. justice system, to push an angle that the jury got it wrong, there's a lot of work to do. I want to hear that he read and analyzed all of the 13,000 pages of trial transcripts, but he's only said that he read eyewitness statements and talked to the police and lawyers prosecuting Jackson. I also want to hear Reed acknowledge that we're not talking about shoplifting here. This is a family with prior fraudulent assault charges, where the kids admit to lying for financial gain. The mother was found guilty of insurance fraud and hiding assets from the government for money. Presented at trial were the many accounts of those who found the family to be taking advantage of them for money. On top of all of that is the rampant contradictions and blatant lying in the family's testimony. Reed suggesting that the jury got it wrong in the Arvizo case without addressing all of the damaging evidence tells me he doesn't want the facts to get in the way of his perfectly plotted story.
Dan Reed consistently belittles Michael Jackson fans and characterizes them as blindly worshiping a child molester. He is quoted in the New York Times as saying, One can only compare them to religious fanatics. Really, they're the Islamic State of fandom.
This name-calling and contemptuous tone Reed takes with the Michael Jackson fans to me reflects poorly on him as a journalist. Because if you're coming into a project saying you don't know anything about the Jackson case, and you claim to be giving the innocence argument a fair shake, you should be able to understand that it would naturally be the fans, who care enough to do the research, collect the transcripts, and put them out in public. As we covered in the Chandler and Arvizo cases, the media was universally invested in Jackson's guilt, and not responsibly researching and reporting on these allegations. And while it's completely fair for Reed to question the bias of fans who promote Jackson's innocence, Reed should be judging evidence put forward on its own merit, not dismissing it condescendingly just because it came from a fan, especially since he admittedly came into his project in complete ignorance of these cases. You've heard us acknowledge after each episode some of the websites and Twitter accounts supporting Jackson's innocence, the Michael Jackson allegations vindicating Michael, the Daily Michael, and the MJJ repository, which are fan-generated. These sites blew me away in their breadth and depth of research into these allegations, citing their source material and collecting reams of court documents so that anyone who wishes to can easily do their own research and come to their own conclusions. I was impressed to see the Michael Jackson fans consistently encouraging people to research these allegations for themselves through unbiased sources like court documents. It's a stark contrast to Dan Reed's response to questions about fact-checking, which is telling people to just watch his film and the impact of the story will convince you.
Dan Reed cites discredited rumors in his promotional interviews.
Reed has repeated the inflammatory falsehood that Jordan Chandler's description of Jackson's privates matched the police photos of him. But this statement is completely unfounded and based on the trickery of District Attorney Tom Snedden. Snedden used his position of authority to mislead the public. Reed ignores the evidence that Jordan Chandler got the circumcision issue wrong. For a brief recap of the most obvious evidence that there was no match, we'll play a clip by Jackson's trial investigator Scott Ross.
So in 1993, Jordy Chandler would have talked to Tom Snedden. He would have given at least his perception of an accurate depiction of what Michael's private parts looked like. They went out and they got a search warrant. That meant that Michael had to comply. He had to go down to the sheriff's department. He had to drop his pants. He had to do whatever said in the search warrant. If Jordy Chandler had an accurate description, if he was right with whatever he said, they would have hooked up Michael right there on the spot.
So Reed chooses to ignore the clear evidence that if there was a match back in 1993, Jackson would have been arrested, but no arrest was made, and police sources were cited stating there was no match.
Reed also brings up the 1993 settlement with Jordan Chandler, saying he was paid off to drop his civil case and that Jackson bought his silence. But Reed fails to acknowledge that the Chandlers from the start had no interest in testifying in court about Jordan's claims, which is why they forced Jackson into a precarious legal situation. They pressured him to settle the civil case, as we discussed in the Chandler episodes. The Chandlers were still perfectly free to testify against Jackson in his criminal case back in 1994 if they were interested in pursuing justice, but by Evan Chandler's own words, he made it clear that they never wanted to do that. Dan Reed gets away with citing these discredited rumors because no one in the media understands the evidence. We have links on our website to more information about the settlement.
Reed refuses to own up to factual errors brought forward after the release of his film.
We're going to cover three examples of factual errors that Dan Reed refuses to acknowledge. Number one is the train station story.
James Safechuck said in Leaving Neverland that he was abused every day at the train station when the relationship with Jackson was first growing, so when Safechuck was 10 or 11, which would be 1988 or 89. He gave details that indicate that the train station could not be confused with any other structure, but building permits and photo evidence showed that the train station wasn't constructed until 1994, 2 years after Safechuck in his lawsuit said that the abuse had ended, and around 5 to 6 years after the so-called honeymoon phase was over. But instead of conceding this error in Safechuck's story, Dan Reed responds by saying that there was no error, and that the train station abuse happened after it was constructed, so 1994 or later, when James was at least 16, and much taller than Jackson. Here's Reed's Twitter response in April 2019 regarding the newly uncovered evidence about the train station.
Nope. No U-turn. No clash of dates. James was present at Neverland before and after the train station was built. In fact, he took photos of the completed station, which we included in the doc. And his sexual contact with Michael lasted into his teens. That's all in the film.
So Reed confidently claims that the train station abuse occurred after its 1994 completion, when Safechuck was 16 or older. But Reed creates a web of contradictions with this response.
First of all, it contradicts Safechuck's own lawsuit, which gives a detailed accounting of how the abuse slowed down in 1990 and had completely stopped in 1992 when Safechuck was 14. To protect his film, Reed is willing to contradict his own subject's lawsuit.
Reed's response also contradicts his own film. Safechuck says in Leaving Neverland that this daily abuse in the train station happened early on, so in 1988 or 1989, when the sexual relationship was just growing. Leaving Neverland is presented chronologically, posting the years on screen for the viewer. And Safechuck's train station story is undeniably presented as happening before 1990. Reed is also contradicting a major theme in his film and his interviews, that Jackson loses interest in boys at puberty.
And by saying Safechuck has photos of the train station proves nothing except that Safechuck had been to Neverland after the train station was constructed, but we already knew he visited the ranch without Jackson present, well into his teenage years. Biographer Smallcomb stated that his research showed that Jackson was living in New York from February through December 1994, recording the History album and living with Lisa Marie Presley. So Jackson's own schedule wouldn't even allow him to be at the ranch in 1994 for daily abuse.
None of it adds up. Neither Safechuck's story about the train station nor Dan Reed's nonsensical response that the abuse happened after 1994. Our second example is Reed's response to his deceptive editing of the news clip from Mark Garagos. As we explained in the last episode, Dan Reed clipped out a key sentence from Garagos' statements, so that it would seem like his harsh words will land on you like a ton of bricks were about Jackson's accuser, Gavin Arvizo. But the sentence that Reed strategically cut out was about the intrusion on Jackson's privacy, revealing that Garagos was talking about the Extrajet case, in which Jackson was secretly recorded on a flight back to L.A.
Garagos himself corrected the Leaving Neverland error in a tweet, noting that these comments referred to this Extrajet case. But when confronted about this mistake, Reed doubles down. Here's his Twitter response.
His remarks at the press conference have everything to do with Jackson's accusers.
Reed will not acknowledge the most clear-cut, deceptive edit in the film.
Our third and final error example is Dan Reed's response when questioned about the memorabilia items Robson burns at the end of the film. On February 19, 2019, Reed is asked the following in an interview with Vice.com.
Were those the real sequin glove and thriller jacket that Robson was burning in the final credits of the film?
And here is Reed's response.
I wasn't there when Wade burned those items, but the photographic evidence suggests those were the real deal, yeah.
It seems odd to me that Reed wouldn't have questioned Wade before releasing his film about the authenticity of the items that went up in flames. This is the obvious question viewers wanted to know, as soon as they saw these potentially high-value items. But Reed is cagey in his response.
A couple of weeks later, the Gist host Mike Pesca asked Dan Reed whether the burned items were actual gloves and jackets worn by Michael Jackson, and this time Reed responded with certainty.
Of course it's all genuine. I verified this with Wade.
So it sounds like in between these two interviews, Reed got solid confirmation that this was an authentic, extremely valuable jacket burning in the film.
But 3 days later, on March 4th, People magazine runs an article where Wade Robson is quoted as saying the thriller jacket we see burning in the film was a replica jacket he wore as a child, and not Michael Jackson's authentic jacket.
So what happened here? On March 1st, Reed says he verified with Wade that it was an authentic jacket worn by Michael Jackson. And on March 4th, Wade says publicly that it wasn't. Of course, just a week earlier, Julian's Auctions disclosed how Wade sold all of his Michael Jackson items of value, so it would appear that Wade had to come clean, but failed to send this correction to Dan Reed. It's another example of Reed's failure to prioritize getting his facts straight.
Just like in Leaving Neverland, Dan Reed in his promotional interviews emphasizes the romance between the accusers and Michael Jackson. In his LA Times interview, Reed states the following.
Robson had a fulfilling sexual and emotional relationship at the age of 7 with a 30-year-old man who happened to be the king of pop. And because he enjoyed it, he loved Michael, and the sex was pleasant. I'm sorry, that's just the reality.
In his Rolling Stone interview, Reed says plainly,
Michael was Wade's lover.
In other statements, Dan Reed reveals that for him, the most upsetting part about Robson and Safechuck's stories is not the physical abuse, but that Jackson cheated on them with other boys or dumped them. Here's what he said in Rolling Stone.
The wedding was a token of Michael's love and how they were going to be together forever. To me, that's repugnant, because obviously Michael had no intention of being with James forever and probably had slept with many other boys. We know he did. We know he slept with Wade while he was seeing James.
In a Cosmopolitan interview from March 2019, Reed states,
arguably, the most harrowing part of the film is how both Wade and James were dropped for other children.
While there's expert consensus that child sex abuse victims can experience a wide range of feelings towards their abusers, including love, the Leaving Neverland romance narrative aligns disturbingly with Victor Gutierrez and the pro-pedophilia themes in his fictional book. Dan Reed describes how Robson, as a 7-year-old, had a fulfilling emotional and sexual relationship with an adult man. Robson says how at age 7, he was excited for the sex with Jackson. This is similar to Gutierrez using the term lovers instead of victims when writing about boys and sexual relationships with Jackson. Gutierrez consistently describes boys like Jordan Chandler looking forward to the sex and enjoying it. I'm not suggesting that Dan Reed himself is pro-pedophilia. I'm saying that he's amplifying pro-pedophilia themes because it works so well with his narrative that the accusers didn't reveal anything for years because they were in romantic love with Jackson. Calling child sex abuse victims lovers and claiming that the children had fulfilling sexual relationships rings loud alarm bells to be 100% certain that Reed has honestly investigated the truth of the allegations. Reed does not reveal the fact that neither Robson nor Safechuck mentioned being in romantic love with Jackson in their detailed lawsuits. Reed also fails to accurately portray the threats alleged in their lawsuits, which they need to get around the filing deadlines. They said Jackson would say over and over how they couldn't tell anyone or they would go to jail, making it clear that they felt fear as part of the abuse. But fear and intimidation work against Reed's simpler, more compelling narrative that the boys felt pure love and excitement, and that's what kept them from being detected by those around them. After discovering how Reed did not honestly reckon with the subject's credibility issues and only talked to parties invested in Jackson's guilt, I was upset that the media didn't put up a greater challenge to Leaving Neverland. It seemed clear to me that Reed's work did not comply with accepted standards of journalism.
Harvard's Journalist Resource issued a report on best practices for documentary filmmaking in 2015. In this report, they recommended the critically acclaimed PBS documentary show Frontline as a model.
We're going to look at some of Frontline's best practices for their documentary programming and see how Dan Reed's Leaving Neverland measures up.
In the very first section under Fairness, the Frontline guidelines state the following.
Since publication of truthful, accurate information is the prime mission of our programs, it should be clear that willful misrepresentation or falsification of program content will be considered unprofessional conduct and will carry the most severe consequences.
Dan Reed repeatedly misrepresented content in Leaving Neverland, such as his deceptive editing of the Mark Garrigou statement, misrepresenting how Jackson actually started his relationship with Safechuck, misrepresenting the fax machine scene with Joy Robson, misrepresenting why the Robsons came to the U.S., misrepresenting the final scene with Robson burning Jackson memorabilia, presenting Blanca Francia's claims of witnessing molestation without stating her credibility issues. Because of all of his misleading content, Reed fails in this first guideline under Fairness.
The frontline guidelines promise the viewer that the subject matter and people in the program will be treated fairly. Here's their definition of fairness.
Fairness means that producers will approach stories with an open, skeptical mind and a determination, through extensive research, to acquaint themselves with a wide range of viewpoints.
Dan Reed did not do this. According to his own interviews, the only people he spoke with were police and prosecutors involved, who we know from the 2005 trial were biased and seeking only confirmatory guilty evidence. Reed appeared to be keeping the project secret from the Jackson family and estate, so his movie could drop like a bomb without any prior counter-arguing to diminish its impact. Reed didn't interview anyone who knows the factual evidence and supports Jackson's innocence, such as Jackson lawyer Tom Mesereau, such as journalist Charles Thompson, or Jackson estate lawyers. And he doesn't interview anyone who could give him an intimate but very different perspective on Robson, such as Brandy Jackson.
The guidelines state that fairness means to try and keep personal bias and opinion from influencing the pursuit of a story. Seek and carefully examine contrary information and views.
We know from his own words that Dan Reed did not carefully examine contrary information and views. There's no accounting for how Reed reconciled the misleading and false statements in the lawsuits of his subjects. In none of Reed's interviews did I hear him say he fact-checked his own subjects' lawsuits. Fact-checking was something that the award-winning New York Times reporters said was critical in their investigation of Harvey Weinstein. But for Reed, he says it was the compelling love story that convinced him, aided by talking to police and prosecutors invested in Jackson's guilt.
The guidelines say to give individuals who are the subject of attack the opportunity to respond to those attacks.
In the film, Wade Robson implicates those working in the recording studio, those working at Neverland, and others working around Jackson as enablers of abuse, but Reed never reached out to any of them to get their side of the story. He was content to present them as Robson described them.
The documentarian should represent fairly the words and actions of the people portrayed, and when appropriate, seek and reflect their viewpoints, even if they have not agreed to be interviewed.
When Dan Reed is questioned about fairness, he always responds that because he included Michael Jackson's videotaped statements of innocence, he has fairly given him representation in the film.
You know, Jackson is dead and he's not here to defend himself, but we include the rebuttals that he made while he was alive, and he recorded plenty of denials, and we've included that in the film and given him a significant presence and his lawyers. You know, so I think this, as far as Jackson's right of reply goes, we have met that fully.
But presenting Jackson saying, "I didn't do it," doesn't come close to representing his case for innocence, as demonstrated by the information in this podcast. And it's disingenuous for Reed to say that it does, especially since Jackson's video statements don't even address these brand new claims by Robson and Safechuck that Jackson never had a chance to refute. To fairly represent Jackson's viewpoint would be to present the court evidence that Robson and Safechuck have lied under oath, and to present the factual contradictory evidence to their stories, such as Safechuck's story about the Grammys. This is why Reed should have given the Jackson estate an actual right of reply, to give them the chance to offer unbiased evidence against very specific allegations made in the film.
The guidelines instruct the filmmaker to present the significant facts a viewer would need to understand what he or she is seeing, including appropriate information to frame the program.
This is a huge fail on the part of Dan Reed.
Dan Reed does not reveal that the cards, faxes, and birthday messages by Jackson were not unique to his subjects, but commonplace. He does not reveal the circumstances around the timing of their lawsuits, with Robson losing out on a job he wanted from the estate, and with Safechuck being sued for hundreds of thousands of dollars just before his disclosure and lawsuit.
Reed left out this contextual information so that he could give his audience the meticulously carved up video and audio that made his story work.
The guidelines say to always be prepared to assist in correcting errors.
Dan Reed fails again. When errors are pointed out, he doubles down, dismissing evidence by saying it's just the crazy Jackson fans.
In the example of the train station, Reed undermines his own subject's lawsuit to try to preserve the integrity of the film. He doubles down on the Mark Garagos error, never addressing the fact that he deceptively clipped out one sentence that makes it clear Garagos was not talking about the Arvizos.
Reed was unwilling to admit error when uncovered. He contradicted his own subject's sworn testimony and contradicted actual press conference footage. This is a striking deviation from accepted journalism practices.
All producers must have a fact-checking procedure at the completion of the program, checking every picture, every date.
Reed does not do this. He misleads his audience with his images and distorted timelines. He should have fact-checked the Grand Canyon story and how the abuse first started, against the Robsons' prior testimony, and presented that discrepancy to his audience. He should have checked out the home loan documents before using Stephanie Safechuck's story. And he should have checked out the bad tour dates before presenting a dramatic grooming story before abuse.
Producers should be prepared to show and cite their sourcing or sources in a fact-checking document or annotated script.
Reed does not do this. He expects you to trust him that he vet these claims, and to trust him when he says he found nothing contradicting his subject's stories. Reed says in his interviews that all you need to know is in his film.
Leaving Neverland makes disturbing and sensational claims that could irreparably damage the reputation and legacy of Michael Jackson. Viewers and the media should hold Reed accountable, not only in fact-checking Robson and Safechuck's stories, but also in fact-checking the Chandler and Arvizo cases that Reed so confidently asserts as valid. Extraordinary claims should require extraordinary and transparent evidence.
Leaving Neverland wins an Emmy for Best Documentary in 2019. The film also received an Emmy nomination for Outstanding Picture Editing, and Dan Reed was nominated for Outstanding Director for a Documentary Program.
After my analysis of Leaving Neverland, I'm left to question how this film can win an Emmy Award and be widely accepted by the media without meeting any of Frontline's fairness standards, standards that are regarded as a model for documentary filmmakers. Reed comes across like a filmmaker of a dramatic fictional movie, carefully crafting his scenes and including only stories, audio, and images that will drive home the most emotional and compelling message for his audience. Reed did accomplish his goal of creating a powerful story about child sex abuse, but Leaving Neverland viewers should not trust that this story is true.
And that completes our coverage of the Leaving Neverland documentary. If you have any questions about Leaving Neverland, you can reach out to us through our website or on Twitter at @Case4Innocence.
In our next episode, we're going to go in a different direction. Because I discovered so much deceit and cunning in the people who've accused Michael Jackson of sex abuse, I found it insightful to study the science of deception. So in the upcoming show, we'll be taking a look at what science tells us about lying and lie detection, and see how this research applies to the Michael Jackson allegations.
You can find all source material for this episode through our website, michaeljacksoncaseforinnocence.com. Thank you for listening to the Michael Jackson Case for Innocence podcast.